countries across the globe begin to emerge from lockdown and try to restart their economies while finding a balance in avoiding further coronavirus outbreaks, it's clear that our world going forward will be much different, at least for a while. The so-called new normal will bring a change in the way we interact with each other, in the way we shop and buy things, and in the way we travel and navigate our cities. This week, we'll look at travel and mobility, two sectors which were already seeing a shift in direction before the pandemic upended our way of life. We'll ask how this changes things going forward, first by hearing from a past guest, Henry Cookson, founder of Cookson Adventures, on escapism and the importance of continuing to explore new and remote destinations. We'll then hear from Alan Visser, CEO of Lincoln Co., and a veteran of the automotive industry, on why car companies have a massive role to play in finding mobility solutions in our cities. And a little later, we'll check in with another previous guest, Julian Hearn, the founder of nutrition brand Huel. He's our expert guest this week, and the serial entrepreneur will answer questions and offer some advice on launching a brand and taking your business to the next level. You're listening to The Entrepreneurs with me, Daniel Bache. First up, time for this week's op-ed on the reasons we travel. After leaving the world of finance, Henry Cookson became a record-setting polar explorer and has since built a multi-million dollar business, Cookson Adventures, which specializes in creating bespoke, once-in-a-lifetime journeys for clients. Here now is Henry.
When travel restrictions were first being put in place, I entered a sort of stage of denial. Not us, not now, can't be for long. For here at Cookson Adventures, we've always been faced with self-set challenges because we strive to reach the unattainable. So why was this to be any different? However, once a grave reality did hit, and it was swift, our minds quickly turned to those outside of Cookson Adventures. The farmer Kum Ranger in Kenya, who relies on visitor donations to care for their wildlife, their rehabilitated rhinos. A family-run lodge in rural Myanmar, spearfishers along the Madagascar coast. All these remote communities whose sole source of income comes from tourism. The ripple effects of this crisis will run further than we can imagine or want to. At Cookson Adventures, although we create many close-to-home journeys, we are perhaps better known for exploring the more remote destinations of our planet. Places such as Antarctica, Svalbard up in the Norwegian Arctic, or even secluded islands and atolls deep in the Pacific. The nature of these journeys, majority of which are logistically complex, can take up to 12 months or longer to design. So pipeline-wise, this means we haven't seen so much of a disruption as other travel companies. And we do predict, with a handful of hope, that there will be a larger demand for more meaningful types of experiences going ahead. And that will often entail more remote destination adventures, such as the ones that I just mentioned, when the world does come back to whatever normality that will be. Escapism is still our priority. We've always taken great pride in making the planning process as immersive as possible. So we'd like to think that we're still continually inspiring our clients in our backwards and forwards interactions to ensure that we take travel beyond the usual concept of what it means to go away. We're having regular conversations with our clients about future trips, even now. There may not be a set departure date, but many of our usual trips often have built-in flexibility and redundancy. So this is just a different set of circumstances to factor this in. We've also launched a campaign that we're calling This Time Next Year. It aims to inspire avid travelers with destinations that they can immerse themselves in for 2021, one of which being the secretive Arabian island of Socotra, which I was scheduled to visit back in March. However, a certain pandemic got in the way of that one. A huge disappointment, as I've wanted to visit there for many, many years. However, it's not cancelled, just merely postponed. Travelling is good for the soul, and a hunger that needs to be fed. For me, it is essential to feed my insatiable curiosity. Of course, we will tread with extreme caution when borders open again, and travel becomes both morally appropriate as well as safe. But when that happens, and it's not for our industry to decide, but what I hope to be true is that people will come back with an enhanced vigor, celebration, and a newfound respect for those things that we might once have taken for granted.
Henry Cookson there, renowned global explorer and founder of Cookson Adventures. My thanks to Henry, and you can hear my full interview with him on episode 371 of The Entrepreneurs. It's now time to bring in this week's expert panelist, and I'm pleased to say we have Julian Hearn, the founder and chief marketing officer of Huel, the UK plant-based nutrition brand he launched back in 2015. Julian sold his first venture called Mashup Media back in 2011, but certainly wasn't ready for retirement. He then bootstrapped Huel to over £40 million in revenue in just 4 years. Julian, welcome back to the show. Of course, we are in the middle of an unprecedented situation. In recent years, Huel has been one of the fastest growing companies here in the UK. But how have you been doing in the past few weeks?
We've been very lucky, really. We sell a food. Food is essential product. So we've actually been doing okay. In March itself, our sales did actually spike extremely highly. We sort of did a massive month. It was our biggest month ever, because I think people were stocking up. Some people were buying, looking for alternatives, because obviously the supermarkets were getting quite empty. Since then, orders have gone back down to normal, or a little bit just below normal. But really, we're very lucky that we're not in the hospitality industry. You know, we're not in bars or restaurants or anything like that. And therefore, we've been quite immune to some of this in terms of the staff. Again, we're quite a cloud-based business now, like most people. So we can all work from home. So virtually all of our team are working from home. And culture and communication is slowed down a little bit. We're on Zoom quite a lot. And I'd rather be in the office, like I think most people. But yeah, I'm very grateful we're not in some other industries where they've had a really hard time, and it's not their fault, which is a massive shame.
Now, I've got a listener question coming up for you, but first I thought I would put one to you myself. Huel, of course, is a great example of how to launch a product successfully. What would be your advice for someone who's about to launch a brand or new product just now?
In terms of the product, you want to try and solve a problem which people have currently got that's not currently being solved by somebody else. If you can find that problem and you can give a unique spin on it, then that will enable you to be a more novel product. You therefore should get more PR, and that means you'll get the ball rolling. Because I think in the early days, the first thing you need to do is make sure you've got that website complete, you've got that product right, you've got the concept, the packaging, the brand, the name. And then it's the chance. Then the next step is to try and get people to know about that product. So you need to get those basics right first, and then that will make your life very easy. Like Huel was a very novel product when we first launched. And so within 3 months, we had loads of national press, word spread, and our sales just kept on going up like that. So I think that would be one of the key things I would focus on, is getting the brand, the positioning, the USP, solve the problem, get the name right, get the packaging right, get the website right, or the copy right, get the images, get that whole thing together, and then start advertising. And online, there's lots of places to advertise. If it's a specific problem you're solving, so for example, say it's a skincare for eczema, you can advertise on AdWords. If it's a product which is very novel and people don't even know they need it yet, like Huel, people didn't know they needed that product, that is something we advertise on Facebook or paid social. There's two good channels there. So that'd be the key areas I'd focus on. But really, the key is getting that ball rolling. You've got to try and get a flywheel rolling. So in the early days, you've just got to put a lot of time and effort in and just think about every little thing. And as soon as you start selling, the next stage is to fulfill the product and the customer service with the other key thing. And if you just really focus on those first 1,000 people that you're going to satisfy, if you make those people really happy and delight them, you go above and beyond what normal customer service would provide, then they hopefully will be so amazed with your company, they would tell their friends, and then word spread from there, and then that's how you grow. Typically, there's lots of things that you don't need in business that are unnecessary, and you don't need them. So I started both my businesses in my house, in my front room. I didn't hire an office to start with. If there was a chance to go to a speaking event or a conference, typically I didn't go. I saved those money until I could afford those. So, and then just do some very simple maths. You know, in the very early days, I worked out how much my product cost and how much my margin was. And therefore, that was my CPA. That was how much money I could spend on advertising per customer. And then the logic was, if I could break even on the first order, then all future orders will be profitable. So you just keep some very simple numbers like that and just focus on, you know, money in, money out, and what the bank account is, And don't stretch yourself too far, because you don't have to grow at rocket speeds. You know, you can grow at a very steady pace, and then it might accelerate as you go. And we didn't take money very early. I know that's not always possible, but my first business, I started with £1,500 and took that to turning over £2 million in the third year. You don't have to raise money, and raising money can be very distracting. It takes a lot of time, takes a lot of effort. And if you're a small business, I would just say, just keep going, get that growth, try and get the month-to-month growth going, improve things, improve everything you can with your product. And really, if you get more money coming in, then your expenditure can go up.
Very well said. We have another great question, which comes from Boris Radicic in France, which is mostly about funding, I think. Him and his wife are hoping to start up more of a lifestyle business. So that will include a guest house, art gallery, yoga retreat type of thing. So let's hear that question now.
Hi, my name is Boris. I'm 35 years old and I'm living in Paris. With my wife, we are planning to open a small luxury hotel or luxury guest house, either in France or in Spain. And my question was how to keep looking for real estate to purchase and get the supporting funding from the bank when their interaction with agency and banks are quite limited in those days. Thank you.
Yeah, I think that funding is going to be super difficult in the next few months, if not next year or so. There's so many companies starting. There's so many companies out there that are growing that you'd probably, most people want to invest in more of a sure thing rather than something, just an idea. This sounds like it's just an idea at the moment. So what I would probably do in the short term is I would probably prove the concept that he's talking about buying a property. So that's a massive commitment. And at the moment, it doesn't sound like he's done it before. And so to commit to that sort of purchase, to buy a property, to launch a retreat, I would take a minimal viable product approach. Just try and find a venue where you could hire and run a yoga retreat, try and make a profit from it. Because if you can go and show the bank or even a potential VC company some numbers to say, look, we ran this yoga retreat. We've done it three times now. Each time we've made a 100% return on our money, and we've got loads of people queuing up to come to these things, that makes you a lot more attractive. You've got some growth data there, you've got some numbers, but just to go with an idea, I think you're really going to struggle. I think that would be the wrong way to do it. So I would probably start with either doing it two ways. I'd either go and hire a venue and run a few, turn a profit, and that you can use that money to reinvest. Or there is even an easier way to do it probably, which is you set up basically a dummy website. You set up a dummy website advertising a yoga retreat with an art gallery in the south of France. You can sort of get pictures and make it look like it's a real thing. You can then advertise on AdWords or on to paid social. You can send traffic to that site. And once people have clicked, book or buy, then you just put an email capture form to say, I'm sorry, this is not available. No, we're just sort of, you can be honest and just say, we're just testing. If you're very interested in this, just leave your email address. And once we're set up, we'll get back in touch with you. So you can do some data collection, but you can then work out your numbers. You can say, well, I spent £100. I was advertising it £1,000 per holiday and 10 people clicked to book. So you can work out what your CPA and what your return would be. So that would be a very cost-effective way to do it. But the real closest way to doing it would be to hire a venue and actually to run some events to get experience, to learn. But the key thing would be to get the data to show somebody else to invest. I would be very reluctant to invest in a property in the south of France without proof of concept.
Great advice there. And the important thing, I think, to key on is that we will want to push people to continue to want to launch small businesses. So important, obviously, around the world to have those small community businesses as well to drive the economy. But I wanted to hear a little bit about a new initiative as well that you've helped to launch in this time, specifically for smaller businesses in the UK. It's called Pledge 30, I believe, where business founders can connect with leading entrepreneurs and successful business people such as yourself for some important advice in this time. Can you tell me a little bit more, Julian?
Yeah, so obviously we're in a very bad situation. So everybody's trying to help, which is it's heartwarming to see. And at Huel, what we've done is donated some product to the National Health, and we've set up a discount scheme for National Health staff. But then it sort of went a bit further than that. We started talking internally about, well, the economy is going to be, the next thing is really going to suffer. So how do we help as a business? How do we help other people? So I said, well, I can give up some of my time to help smaller businesses. Smaller businesses are the lifeblood of future big businesses. So you know, if I can give some advice, which I know people have given me advice over the years and I found it incredibly valuable. I listen to a lot of podcasts, which I find are super useful to learn. You can hear from experts all over the world. So I said, well, why don't I put myself forward to offer some of my time? If I give up, you know, an hour of my time per week, I could speak to two small businesses and give them half an hour. So it's like the pledge 30 minutes. And but I'm only one person. So I spoke to a couple of other contacts I've got, guys who've run their own businesses, they're CEOs of their own businesses, and got lots of advice to give, and asked them, and they said they would do the same. And then it sort of spread from there. So other people are offering the same. So the gist of it is that, you know, if you're a small business, get in contact with me or some of the other guys who've done the Pledge 30, and just put down a few details about, you know, one of the key things I ask for is I want people who've got a number of staff, because if I can help a small business who's got a number of staff, I can hopefully save those jobs. So if we always try and help each other, then there's always somebody that is got a smaller business than you, and they're in the same position you were, and you can help lift them up. So that was the key principle behind it.
Julian, thank you so much for your time.
No problem.
Julian Hearn, founder of nutrition brand Huel. And you can hear my full interview with Julian on episode 421 of The Entrepreneurs. Now, while many cities are busy planning a future with more pedestrian areas and cycling lanes, the reality is that cars will remain an important mode of transportation. So it might be surprising to hear an automotive CEO say they hope to sell fewer cars in the future. Alan Visser is this week's guest. He is CEO of Gothenburg-based Lincoln Co., which is part of the Chinese-owned Geely Auto Group. He is a 30-year industry veteran who believes car makers have as big a role to play as anyone in finding mobility solutions for our city's future. Lincoln Co. launched in China 2 years ago, the only country where they currently have cars on sale and on the road. Last week, they launched their 05 model to the Chinese market, and later this year, their cars will be introduced to the European market. And Visser remains convinced that sharing platforms, like the one Link will release later this year, are the way forward.
We started this whole concept back in the end of 2015, and my briefing at that time was to start a new car brand, a new car company, and I basically, if I can say so, rejected, saying that it's ridiculous to start a new car brand because, one, there's so many good car brands, all cars are good now, why create yet another one? And secondly, I, as you may know, I've been in the car industry for my whole life, which is a long time, 33 years, and I've been shocked by the fact that the consumers are changing at an incredible pace. The consumer needs, the consumer today has nothing to do with a consumer of 10 years ago, let alone 100 years ago, and yet the car industry today is basically the same as 100 years ago. The business model is exactly the same. The cars have moved on and the product is a lot better. But basically the business model is the same. We engineer, design cars, build them in our factories, ship them to dealers, and dealers sell and fix them. So my idea has always been, if the industry doesn't move, if this is like an old dinosaur industry bulldozing its business model over a changing consumer, and I'm just, and we're just convinced that there's a lot of customers out there ready for something else. We're not as arrogant of saying they all got it wrong and we got it right. I'm just saying there's a lot of people out there who want something else. So we said, let's do something else. Let's not just sell cars. Let's improve mobility. And on the other hand, that was my first rationale. The second rationale is, and this may sound a little bit religious, but it's actually genuine. If you've worked 33 years in the car industry and you keep on telling your 20-year-old children, I'm selling cars, which is a very radical summary, it doesn't feel that good because it's not something to be proud of in a world where sustainability is not just a nice story, but it's essential. And I think we can do something within that industry that turns a pretty polluting industry into a sustainable product, but also business model. So our idea is not only to bring cleaner cars on the road, but also to use these cars better. If you just think of the simple statistic that the average car on this planet is used for 5% of the time, which means it's 95% of the time idle. That's just insane. So we said, let's really completely change the business model around and do mobility in a lifestyle and sustainable way. So that's it in a very short summary. So we don't sell cars, even though if our consumers are interested in buying one of our vehicles, we won't say no. But our communication is about selling mobility and mobility with a lot of services around it. I like to call it the Netflix or the Spotify of the car industry. We don't sell CDs or DVDs. We sell, in our case, mobility. That would be the summary of the story.
So talk to me a little bit about how that works in practice. We'll come on to things that are happening today and maybe different in the way that we think about mobility moving forward, especially in cities. But tell me how that works in practice, because obviously people still need to have a car in many different places. And certainly that's different in various cities across the world. But tell me how you've rolled out the offering.
Yeah, so we have a car. So there's still a car there that's in the middle of our model, of our business model. We will talk about it less than the traditional car companies do, even though we're, of course, very proud of it. But our idea is that you don't go to a dealership, choose a car, pay for it, and then take it home for the next 5 years. Our idea is you go online or in one of our few stores, which are in the middle of the city and which are our own stores and which are lifestyle stores, where you can do a lot of other things also at night. And you decide if you sign up to become Link & Co member. So we sell a membership. And in that membership that is monthly, you can become member for a month, get a car to your access, get access also to lifestyle events, whether it's the opening of a new restaurant, film festivals, fashion shows. It opens you to a world that we believe is relevant for this type of consumers, and you have access to a car. If after 2 months, 3 months, 1 month, or a year, you say, I don't want the car anymore, then you return it. So, and the reason why we do that is because we see that young customers out there, they are ready to spend a lot of money actually on mobility, whether it's an Uber or public transportation or rent a car, etc. But they don't want to spend $15,000 or pounds or euros on buying a vehicle. And even though they're ready to spend $500 per month maybe on transportation, they are not ready to say, I'm going to spend that 500 now every month for the next 12 months, because they have no idea what they're going to do next month. So we think that the total non-commitment part of it is essential, and that I think what makes us different.
You know, in the place that we are in right now, I'd just be curious to hear sort of where the company was at when this situation, this pandemic struck and, you know, put a lot of cities into lockdown. Obviously, that's changed how people are thinking about getting around. People may be moving around a little bit less. Where were you sort of when that started, and how quickly did things change for you after that?
Yeah, it's obviously, and I often get asked the question, how will the pandemic change the world and what will be the impact on people? And I really don't know. I would be arrogant to say this and this is going to change. I don't know. If I've learned some things in life, one of them is that we have a shockingly short memory. People have a shockingly short memory. I was watching a film of Australia, the fires in January just a week ago, and I was shocked how that it seems like history. And it was so horrible. But now there's something else. So I don't know. So maybe in X months time, we don't talk about it anymore. I don't know. But it's what I do think is, if it does have an impact on our specific industry and the consumer's mind, I would guess that it's probably that people see that owning a car is not necessarily the best thing you can do. Because like in this period, that car is standing there in almost the entire world idle, is not being driven. Whereas if you had been a member of Link & Co now, you would just have said, I'm going to return it. It would have been, in all honesty and in all selfishness, for us a financial disaster. Our cash flow suddenly would have been a huge issue. But let's face it, for a consumer, it would have been the right thing. So I think, if at all, my view is that consumers will, by definition anyway, the need to own and buy a car, I think, is dropping anyway already. I think, if at all, that Corona it could indeed accelerate that process, that the need to own such a big asset is not necessarily the best choice.
You know, I think I've read from you in past that you've said it's actually better that we sell less cars going forward. And people may be shocked to hear someone say that that is in the car business. My idea, though, is the company is geared towards people who are thinking about city life more broadly. They may also be people that run or walk or cycle to work as well. They're wanting this not to be their main mode of transportation, just an option and something to add to their life in the city or wherever they are. Obviously, now a lot of people, a lot of cities, politicians are thinking about what our space looks like moving forward. European cities especially, a number have taken drastic measures in recent years. Paris, Madrid, now you've got, I think, Brussels and Milan adding on that with this latest pandemic as well. So there's a big shift in how we're thinking about cities. I wonder if that's a big part of what you guys are doing as well.
It is, absolutely. And if you see how more and more people are living in the big cities, the urbanization is continuing to grow. But yet we also see that those people then during their free time, whether it's the evening or the weekends, they want to escape from the cities. And so the I think the mobility needs are going to be there in any way. I'm pretty sure of that. But you're right also, and I like what you mentioned. It's like it may sound odd, but trust me, it is true that, first of all, we don't call ourselves a car company. But if you would, we will be the only car company that doesn't measure ourselves by the number of sales. And I'm always intrigued by a lot of our, let's say, colleague car brands who go out and say, we're not a car brand anymore, we're a mobility brand. But then you see the press releases and they say, we've sold 10% more than last year. And then I think it becomes a little bit hypocrite. It's our target is not going to be the number of sales in a month. It's going to be the number of members, a bit like, again, Spotify and Netflix. And if we can have less cars on the road but utilize them better, then we've achieved our goal.
Just to look at your experience as well and what the car industry has been in past, it's very competitive, right? Obviously, you're looking very much at what the other manufacturers are doing. And if I can try to work in a car driving metaphor here, now I think you're looking more down the road and not looking in the other lanes. I think you're just looking ahead. But I wonder if you're also thinking about what the other companies are doing on the sustainability front, or, as I say, only looking forward now.
No, we're really, and I know this may sound arrogant, but I'm not even, I wouldn't say interested. I still like cars, of course, but I'm not intrigued by what other car companies are doing. I'm intrigued by what other startups are doing and other companies in general are doing. Every time when I go to an automotive event and do a presentation, I listen to the others and I think, wow, we're cool, we're on the right track. But when I go to other events where startups and people who are thinking of new business models, then I start thinking, oh, shit, are we modern enough? Are we going far enough? So I think I almost force my team also, don't look at the car companies, because they are, sorry to say, they're dinosaur industry. Let's look at areas where innovation comes from and let's measure ourselves against those.
You know, just lastly, Alan, I know I've taken a lot of your time. I'm just curious about where you think there will be growth in this sector. Where might there be opportunity for somebody that is moving into mobility? And where do you think we'll see the biggest expansion in years to come?
Well, first of all, I think that autonomous drive is going to happen. I think electromobility is going to happen, and I sure hope it does. I think one of the things that I think are underrated in the mobility industry, I would even say more than in the car industry, is the brand. And I need to be careful what I say now, but there's a lot of convenience brands out there that are very, very strong in what they do, but they're a convenience. And okay, I'll be direct. Uber is very, very convenient. It's a fantastic tool and it's a much more convenient than taxi. But if tomorrow there's a brand, and it exists already, that does exactly the same as Uber, but 20% cheaper, we all go to that new brand. And I believe that there's more than just good convenience, which we, of course, want to offer. I believe there's a lot of room for brands. People want to be part of a community, part of a brand. So what Lynk & Co, what we want to do is, yes, offer that convenience with the subscription, the car you have available for a month, but also build an element of emotional linkage to a brand, to a product, to a service that is more than just it's easy to use. I think there's a lot of opportunity for brands. And to my information, the young consumers of today, and they are not millennials. I hate to use the word millennials. It's not young people. It's people that are young of mind. I probably say that because I want to be part of it myself. I think people with are young of mind, they care about brands more than I think we believe.
Very well said. Alan, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
That's Alan Visser, the CEO of Gothenburg-based Link & Co. My thanks to Alan for his time. That is it for today's show. Thanks to our producer, Holly Fisher, and to Christy Evans, who mixed and edited this show. Don't forget to get your questions in for next week's expert panel, question@monocle.com. I'm Daniel Bache. Thank you so much for listening, and goodbye.